This is the Strictly State Podcast with Curtis Kitchen and your host, Jeff Burkhardt. Two of radio's finest will team up each and every week to cover national sports headlines, the Big 12, and everything K-State. To listen and download, visit KitchenKC.com. Now, here's your host, Jeff Burkhardt.
Each and every week, they seem to find a new way to get it done, and this past Saturday against the Texas Longhorns, it was no exception for the Kansas State Wildcats. They emerge from Darrell K. Royal Memorial Stadium with a 17-13 victory. You are listening to the Strictly State Podcast. Again, I'm your host, Jeff Burkhardt, joined by Curtis Kitchen of 610 Sports in Kansas City. And before we jump into everything, Curtis, I know you made the trek out to Austin. Could you just talk a little bit about what it was like watching a game from Darrell K. Royal Memorial Stadium, just the overall atmosphere of Austin on game day?
Yeah, absolutely. It was, I didn't know what to expect. I'd heard about it from fans, from friends, from people who had lived there before in years past. And to a T, or almost really everyone across the board said, you're going to have a great time. And of course, you don't really know what that means. So I get down there, and it was just, and I'll tell people, I drove straight down and drove back a couple days later, and it was about 11-hour drive each way, and went pretty fast. I think I made, I think I did a good job of making efficient stops, I'll just say that. But once you got down there, you enjoyed Austin a little bit. The town itself was extremely laid back, but with energy, and it was a good crowd. You get inside the stadium, and I know people in this part of the country like to make fun of Texas a little bit, and always use the everything's bigger and better in Texas, and kind of use that against people from there. But when you see the way that that football is revered, respected, whatever word you want to use, and the pomp and circumstance that goes into every Texas game, really. It's something to watch. I mean, I know a lot of folks that listen to this podcast are obviously familiar with the way that Kansas State approaches things, and I think they do a very good job, but it's the best way to explain it then would be to say what Kansas State does, you roughly need to double or triple it in size, and that is what Texas is, and Texas football at the stadium. And I'm talking, multi-day, not hours, but days worth of tailgating leading up to the game. Some people were in the parks and things around campus on Friday afternoon, and Friday evening stayed over, and then kicked it back up on all day on Saturday. And then you see the immense size of the band, and you see the state flag that they roll out on the field for the pregame, and just the uniforms and the detail that goes into each act and in each performance and just across the board, it's pretty amazing. And then I was ecstatic that, of course, toward the end of the game, they lead the media down to the field so you can get on the field and see players and walk toward the post game interview rooms and things like that. But to be on the field and be able to look up and look around and see 100,000 people all looking down toward your general direction. I know how I felt, just the awe that goes into that. And that was by far the largest stadium that I've ever been in my life. But to feel how I felt about it, I cannot imagine what it's like for a recruit and then to be a player and then to be a starter and be a part of that experience for the better part of 3 or 4 seasons, however long guys are there. And to know that people are there to watch you, you hear that schools have recruiting advantages and things like that. I don't know that I really fully appreciated what that meant. You can spit the words out, but to really know what might be going through a recruit's head or through a player's head when they've got that kind of atmosphere, it's something that flatly I'll never forget.
Certainly one of the great venues in all of college football in Austin, really one of the great college towns, not only in the Big 12 Conference, but in all of the country. And I know a lot of people that listen to this podcast will go on record as saying that they prefer the intimate environment that you get in Manhattan. And I, for one, I can really appreciate Kansas State, and I have been a part of that environment for a number of years, and I love going to Bill Snyder Family Stadium on a game day. But that said, it is a different animal down in Austin. And Curtis, you kind of touched on this as well, how the expectation level is so high of everyone that's involved with the University of Texas program. And I guess this past week, I gained a new appreciation for the University of Texas, for its fan base, and for head coach Mack Brown. And really, not only this past week that has influenced my decision, but really what's happened the past 2 years with regard to Texas football. It's very well documented that it hasn't been good and it hasn't been at the level that people expect it to be at. And I know it's easy in that situation to make the coach out to be the scapegoat, but I think a lot of people tremendously undersell the type of job that Mack Brown has and what he is demanded to do on a day-to-day basis and what he's demanded to do year in and year out as the head football coach at the University of Texas. And trust me, I know all the arguing points against Mack Brown. I was one who thought he should have been on the hot seat after last season, and for the following reasons. Texas does get its pick of the litter in terms of recruiting. If Mack Brown wants to sign a five-star prospect, 9 out of 10 times, that young man will end up in burnt orange. If Mack Brown wants to completely overhaul his coaching staff and bring in some of the great young minds in college football, as he did this past season, Mack Brown can do it because Texas has those kind of resources, the kind of resources that most schools in the Big 12 don't have access to, and for that matter, really most schools in the entire country don't have access to. But even with that said, I don't think people understand how truly difficult it is to get all of the egos that are involved in the Texas program. And trust me, and I'm sure Mack Brown would attest to this as well, there are egos that are involved with the University of Texas football. Mack Brown has to deal with five-star kids that have been told probably since the age of 10 or 11 or 12 that they are God's gift to football. And he has to get all of those kids on the same page. He has to get all of those kids to buy in to what he is selling. And I know in Manhattan, we are extremely privileged and blessed to have a guy like Bill Snyder who somehow manages to get every possible ounce of talent out of guys who were skipped over and looked over in terms of recruiting by most schools in the entire country. But Bill Snyder manages to take every ounce of talent out of those kids and put it together to make a winning football program as he's done this past season. And I know when the average K-State fan looks at the K-State roster and they look at the Texas roster and they go back and glance at how highly touted some of those Texas prospects were coming out of high school, and they see what K-State's doing and they see what Texas is doing, they're going to think in their mind that there really is no excuse for Texas to not win 9, 10, 11 games each year because of the type of talent that they have. But still, at the end of the day, Mack Brown's doing the exact same thing that Bill Snyder is doing. He is trying to adapt to the personnel that he has to get his guys to buy in, to do what he wants them to do as a football team. And really, this is the year that I've seen it more so than any year in the past because of all the youth that's on this Texas team. There's a lot of young talent. There's a lot of first-time starters. And a lot of people are going to shortchange this Texas team and what it's been able to do. But keep in mind, three first-time starters on the offensive line, an unclear quarterback situation with two freshmen. There's a whole lot being asked of Mack Brown. And I think he's doing a good job of handling it. And I still think he's one of the best coaches in all of the Big 12. And I've gained a new appreciation for him after what I saw this past week and what I've seen from him this season.
I think the knock that he gets at times is unfair, but then again, when you're on that stage, you're expected to produce, and you know, produce means different things at different levels. You're expected to be better at Texas than you are even, and I'll say it, even at a Iowa State or a K-State or a KU or any of those, or even maybe a Missouri. I mean, it's Texas football. It is, you know, it's akin to Alabama football. It's akin to maybe not even LSU. I mean, there are certain schools that you're supposed to be that is at that level. You may have other teams move up that once in a while will get into that realm once in a while, but year in and year out, you're supposed to be at the top. And, you know, it was another game with Texas and K-State that you walk away and you don't really know how the team that won. And you don't know how exactly the team that lost. And it seems kind of generic to say that, but I mean, it seemed like Texas's defense especially was the best unit on the field for the entire game. They had one or two misplays. Mack Brown said four or five, and he obviously had a chance to go back and look at the tape and knew what he was looking for or saw something that he thought he was looking for. and his staff did as well. So they say four or five plays. But when you had two teams that were pretty evenly matched, really across the board from style on down, maybe, you know, obviously the talent level at Texas is better across the board. But in terms of style and in terms of how they call the games and things like that, I mean, the stats, everything on paper said Texas should have won that game. And, you know, so while the knock on Mack Brown is that he loses big games, you know, it's not like it wasn't like the Oklahoma game for them this year. And you're right, they're dealing with some youth. And I think that the youth cost them a little bit in that game against K-State. But it, you know, this was just a close, hard-fought Big 12 game. I know that Mack Brown detractors will say he shouldn't lose those games at home, but he did. And I think everyone else who may be a little more level-headed about things just saw one team had to win a game, and one team, you know, one team won it in the final possession, and one team didn't quite have enough at the end, and that's the way it played out. So. Yeah, you know, Mack Brown's detractors are going to have, you know, one more feather in their cap, I guess, if they want to look at it that way. But at the end of the day, I think it was just a hard-fought game, and Texas came up short, and K-State is now one win away from having 10 on the season.
It was absolutely a hard-fought game right down to the bitter end. You mentioned the youth. We'll talk about that here in just a moment. Before we jump into the K-State breakdown, let's talk about Big 12 games from week number 12, and we have to start off with the game that occurred last Friday. How about the Iowa State Cyclones trailing 24-7 at one point to the second-ranked Oklahoma State Cowboys, then coming back to knock off Mike Gundy's squad in double overtime in dramatic fashion. What can you say about Iowa State?
Oh, you just say that they take advantage, and I think they never got down on themselves, and I think the comparison is very easy. You know, I think a Paul Rhodes team is extremely similar to a Bill Snyder team in that he gets the right kind of kids for his program. He teaches them never to give up, and he says, just stick with your plan and we'll see what happens, even when we get down. And that's what they did. They got down 24-7, like you mentioned, but then Oklahoma State got careless. For the first time this year, I really felt like Oklahoma State sort of mailed one in and started turning the ball over, and Iowa State took advantage, scored some points, and that's when momentum kicks in. That's when players' confidence kicks in or returns. Paul Rhodes on the Big 12 coaches teleconference this week said that you know, his team had a great week of practice leading up, and they were confident going in. So when they made some plays and got back in that game, they felt like they belonged, and that's obviously very dangerous for a team that's trying to pull a major upset like that. And I mentioned that you know, it looked like Oklahoma State just sort of, you know, just nailed it in at that point. And It's bothersome, and obviously it hasn't completely derailed their chance at a BCS title appearance. I mean, they've got to get some major help now, but it wasn't the end of the world. They didn't drop down to 8, 9, or 10 or something crazy like that. I mean, they're still sitting just on the outside at 4, but they did not do the I don't know, maybe the second most important thing that a team on a mission has to do, and that's finish. And I'd say the first is just preparing yourself through the week and not having a trap game or a letdown going in where you just get blown out from the beginning and you're never in the game. Second most is being able to finish the game. And they were up 24-7, and the wheels came off, and they didn't show the composure that you would expect from a team that to this point had played in some big games already, but had shown their ability to roll through, handle a little bit of adversity, and move on. And they just flat didn't on Friday night. And maybe they were due for a letdown. You know, you always talk about teams that have never been there before. Oklahoma State, with each game, was getting just a little bit closer. Obviously, in 2 weeks, they had Oklahoma and Oklahoma State. And maybe they got caught looking ahead a little bit in the third quarter, which is possible. I know most people think, you know, when you look ahead, you skip an entire week and you forget to play. Sometimes you get into that second, third quarter, fourth quarter even, and you think you've got it, and you let up. And with an Iowa State team, you can't do that. Paul Rhodes has proven that he has coached his guys to play to the end. And credit them, they took advantage of the turnovers, put some points on the board, and then held on at the end. And it seems like we talk about it, you know, maybe once a year, that Paul Rhodes finds one signature win, and it's another gigantic milestone victory early in his tenure there at Iowa State. And maybe not even, you know, nothing is more important than, you know, for that team to be bowl eligible now moving forward. Pretty darn remarkable considering the schedule and how high it ranked on difficulty when this season started.
Plenty of statistical anomalies in play in this game, most notably the turnover margin. And Iowa State, still the last place team in the conference in that department this week. They're minus six on the year. But against Oklahoma State, they are able to force the Pokes into five turnovers. And as you mentioned, Curtis, they take advantage of them. That's how they're able to get back in this football game in the second half. And one more note about the final two quarters of play in this football game. Oklahoma State scored very early on against Iowa State in that second half at the 12:33 mark, to be exact. Iowa State blanked Oklahoma State for the better part of 27 minutes. That is an exceptional accomplishment for a defense that doesn't have a whole lot of talent on it. They exploited some mismatches. They made a lot of sure tackles in open space against some playmakers for Oklahoma State, and they're able to pull off a huge, colossal upset in the college football world. It's thrown the BCS into complete disarray, which I am all in favor for. Oklahoma State has now dropped down to fourth in the standings. Certainly not out of the national championship chase are the Oklahoma State Cowboys, but they will need a big win against rival Oklahoma in the Bedlam game coming up not this weekend, but next. Other games in the Big 12 last week, no surprise in College Station, Texas A&M hammering Kansas 61-7, the final in that game. Missouri is able to hold off an upset-minded Texas Tech squad this past Saturday at Faurot Field in Columbia. They get a 31-27 win over the Red Raiders, a game in which Texas Tech was really leading for a majority of the contest. But Seth Deggie, of course, throwing a pick in the late stages of the game, allowing Missouri to hold on 31-27. Texas Tech falls to 5-6. Missouri now to 6-5 on the season. Bowl eligible are the Missouri Tigers, but they do it without their head coach, Gary Pinkel, who, as I'm sure most of our listeners know, was arrested for DUI earlier in the week leading up to the game. And Curtis, we didn't get a chance to talk about that last week. I'll ask you about it this week. Pinkel put himself in a horrible position in my mind, and had the university elected to enforce the same punishment on him that Pinkel enforced on his players who were found guilty of the same DUI offense, Gary could have possibly missed out on coaching in the last Border War game between Kansas and Missouri. What is going through his mind, and why is he putting himself into that type of position in the week leading up to a game?
Well, you don't know, and I'll preface everything else by saying I'm not one of those folks who immediately jumps on a soapbox and says, well, shouldn't have done it. You know, how could you do such a thing? Because, look, when you're in that environment, when you're in that profession, when you're in that lifestyle, you're going to be around those situations a lot. And I'm not going to try to sugarcoat it for anybody and say, no, you know, you're not, because you are. I mean, that's what a large part of the social aspect to that lifestyle is. It's around alcohol. But for that said, the entire thing is just completely unfortunate, because I look at it, and I know some people look at it differently, and that's fine. This is how I look at it. They want to say, well, you know, he was extremely lucky not to, you know, I wonder how many other times he's done this, and oh, I can't believe it's probably, you know, it's got to be a problem, and all of those things. And I would say, you're right, he has probably done it a lot of other times. Now, I'm not saying he's trained at it or anything like that. I'm not trying to make light of the situation, but I'm saying that some people are able to handle a little bit more. He didn't that night. It's unfortunate that on a game week he got caught for it, and you move on. I don't think he needed to be overly hammered for it, no pun intended. I don't think he needed to be made an example of, except for, and this is where I think my point comes in now, is when you've had the issues that you've had in that program with especially with the exact same charge with DWI, you can't. I mean, we're not talking about a problem that has only been once here, or every few years you get a kid who's new on campus and hasn't quite acclimated himself, or maybe puts himself in a bad spot, whatever. You're talking less than a year, or a little less than a year and a half, a little over a year, that you've had multiple players and a member of your staff pegged for the same thing. And for you to have to be the leader in that example, you can't. You just can't. And I say that's why it's unfortunate for me, because had it been any other sort of minor rule breakage, then I don't think people would look at it the same way, and I'm not even sure I would look at it the same way. It's not the act itself that I have a problem with, although I guess I'm more lenient when it comes to that kind of stuff than a lot of people are, and maybe that's a fault of mine. I'm not sure. But you can't, it blows my mind that you would be on the record so many times in a very short time frame about, you know, not having people not doing it. You know, you can't, you're the one saying this can't happen. We've got to do better. We can't, you know, whatever. And then you put yourself in that position and get caught. It's unfortunate. And the more unfortunate part for me on the whole is the way that it's been handled since then. The press conference that Gary Pinkel had this week, earlier this week at his lawyer's office, just to again go over, you know, why he pled guilty and wanted to move on from it. I don't have a problem with him wanting to move on from it. I think that's the right way to go. But, you know, some people said, well, why not wait until after your suspension, then you can talk about it later in the week if you want. I think they just need to let it go at this point. It you know, it could have been worse, obviously. It wasn't, thankfully. But now that it's over, just move on and let it, you know, let things go and get back to coaching your team, who, you know, it got a win. You're bowl eligible. Then you've got KU coming up this weekend. You know you're not going to miss that game now, although I would have said, you know, originally it was thought that he may miss the final two games. You know, that may not have been such a bad thing, and especially because I don't think that KU – or I don't think that Missouri needs Gary Pinkel on the sideline to beat Kansas, and we can talk about that too. But, you know, I wish it would go away for Gary Pinkel, for – Missouri, for his team, for all of it. It could have been worse. It wasn't. He dealt with it. He's pleading guilty for it, and let it go. And I know that a lot of people don't want to see it that way, but that's kind of how I look at it, is just move on.
Well, you know, this sort of thing is commonplace. Let's not sit here and kid ourselves and act like it isn't. It's not just happening at the University of Missouri. It's not just happening to football players and football coaches. It's happening everywhere throughout the country. And I do kind of want to make one quick point on that before we do jump into it. I think it's horribly unfortunate that so many people have now become numb to the idea of a DUI, numb to the idea of what a DUI means, and just there's a collective disregard for other drivers that are out on the road. And it's horrible that that's what this is degenerated down to. And I know how tempting it is to, even after a couple of drinks, to try and make that drive back. But on the same token, guys, it's equally as easy to just make a call to a designated driver, call a cab, do whatever you got to do. Just make sure you don't jeopardize the lives of other drivers on the road. I'll get off the soapbox now, and we'll get back to the issue at hand. Obviously, Missouri's going to take that portion of Gary Pinkel's salary that has been frozen. It's going to amount to over $300,000. That's going to be given to anti-drunk driving charities. Obviously, a very nice move there by the University of Missouri. Pinkel's going to be doing some community service as well as part of his plea agreement. So, good moves there. They're handling this expeditiously. And on a more personal note with regard to Gary Pinkel, I, truth be told, I've always thought of him as one of the better guys in this conference. And I know he's not going to be with us in the Big 12 next year, but I certainly hope for his sake that he does whatever is necessary to restore his reputation and become known as one of the good guys in the SEC as soon as possible. We'll move back to football now, and we'll go to a big-time game that took place in Waco this past Saturday, and it was a monumental upset for the Baylor Bears. They knock off the fifth-ranked at the time, Oklahoma Sooners, 45-38. Robert Griffin and company, 51 seconds left in the game. They're tied. They have the ball close to their own 20-yard line. Robert Griffin looked like Art Briles and company were playing it a little bit conservative, looking to go into overtime, but RG3 breaks off a couple of nice runs, gets him down to midfield, and then lofts a beautiful 34-yard touchdown pass to Terrence Williams with just 8 seconds remaining in the game. Robert Griffin easily upstages and outduels Landry Jones, at least in my mind. Both throw for over 400 yards. Robert Griffin goes 21 of 34, 479, 4 touchdowns, no picks, and in my mind, far better performance than what Landry Jones put up. Landry, 36 of 51, 447 yards, 0 TDs, one interception for Landry. And I don't want to talk so much about what this game means to Baylor, and obviously it is huge. It's the first program's first ever win over the University of Oklahoma. They were 0-20 against the Sooners going into that game. But now, Robert Griffin, so many people have had kind of written him off on the Heisman ballot because Baylor had underachieved, I guess, to an extent. A lot of people were hoping to see Baylor break through this year, and I know early on Baylor didn't have the kind of success that a lot of people were looking for and kind of tapered off early on in the season, but they're surging at the right time, and they have a chance to win 9 games here in the regular season and put themselves in a position to be in a very nice bowl game. As far as Robert Griffin goes, really, when so many people look and talk about the Heisman, they take into consideration the entire body of work. And I hope, for Robert Griffin's sake, that people are looking and seeing what this kid has accomplished over the course of the season. I know they're going to see the L's early on, but I think a lot of that is to be attributed more so to Baylor's defense than anything else. Robert Griffin has been absolutely sensational and done whatever is necessary to make and help Baylor win football games. He's thrown for over 3,000 yards. He's hitting on over 75% of his passes, 33 touchdowns, just 5 picks for RG3. Has to be, in my mind, a Heisman finalist, and certainly a guy that's going to be seen in New York. I know it's a popularity contest, but Curtis, he has to be one of those top 5 candidates.
Oh, absolutely. I think that was even before this week, but it just, to me, it proves how fluky and how flaky the Heisman race is during the season, and that, you know, some people get written off well before they should. Some people are on the list entire seasons where they should not be. And then you have a lot of other things that just happen in and out, and guys' names come on the list and go off the list. And I've never been a fan of the entire process, to be honest with you. But this, talking about Robert Griffin specifically, absolutely, the kid should be on there. We saw it at K-State. We've seen it throughout the year. Yeah, Baylor's dropped some games, but week in and week out, for the most part, Griffin has found a way to be extraordinary. Whether it's waiting till the last quarter and a half after being basically shut down, like and credit KU's defense for doing that. I think Baylor had something like 180 yards through 2.5 quarters, but then they have over 200 yards in the fourth quarter, come back in a historic fashion and beat Kansas. We see him, the accuracy with which that kid can deliver a deep ball is just uncanny. And I know he doesn't, it's a strong arm, but it's a different ball. He throws it up in the air and that thing moves, but it doesn't hang in the air. And I don't know how he does it. It still gets there in a pretty quick fashion, even though it seems to go higher than normal. And it allows his receivers to run into the ball and make some spectacular catches. Don't get me wrong, Baylor's got some sick talent at receiver as well. But the way he's able to dictate final plays, and when a coach like Bob Stoops apparently loses heart and decides that he's got to go for the win right then, or loses his mind and tries to call a timeout where the other team is trying to get to overtime, credit Baylor and credit Robert Griffin. He makes some plays with his feet. Like you said, it gets him in a position where he can loft it toward the end zone, and they get it done.
And let's not forget, talk now of him being one of the top draft picks in this upcoming NFL draft, which looks to be very quarterback rich. Guys like Matt Barkley, Brandon Whedon, of course, Andrew Luck. We all know a lot of big name guys in there, but Robert Griffin has to be up in that list. And I for one, assuming that the Chiefs do bottom out here and finish in the neighborhood of 5-11, or perhaps even 4-12 if they lose out for the remainder of the season. I don't know if that'll happen or not, but I certainly would not mind seeing RG3 donning the Chiefs cardinal and gold on Sundays.
Oh boy, yeah. You said another story for another day. Would you take Robert Griffin in a Chiefs uniform this week?
I would. I will say this. I liked what I saw from Tyler Palko on Monday Night Football. The first two interceptions, clearly not his fault, balls that were deflected off of wide receivers' hands. The third one into triple coverage, that's obviously on him. But I probably...
And just to finish that thought, yeah, I mean, with Palko, right, he had some yardage. He did a decent job. To me, he did what a backup should look like. He's not going to be as flawless as your starter, or as your starter should be. He's going to move the ball against a defense that allows yards, which the Patriots do. But then the Patriots did what they do, and that's not allow many points. The Chiefs at one point in that game, I think it was toward the fourth quarter, had something like 6 possessions in Patriots territory and came away with 1 field goal. And, part of that was the turnovers. Part of that was just some bad decision-making. And that's obviously not good enough. And I think that falls actually more on the team in general than it does just on one player, and especially on a backup quarterback making his first start on Monday Night Football. But all of that said, we go back to Robert Griffin. The kid can make plays, and that's what he does. And he has grown up. We've seen it over the last couple of years. When he first got to school as a freshman, he was a runner, and it cost him. He got his knee taken out. He tore up his ACL. He had to come back after that. And since that time, has worked on becoming an accomplished passer, and we absolutely know he can do that now. Without a doubt, he's one of the top quarterbacks in the country. And even though his team has lost a couple of games, if you're going to give it to the best collegiate football player, I don't know how at this point, I don't know how you could go against a guy who makes plays like Griffin does.
Absolutely, and I hope we see him in New York. And I know a lot of it's a popularity contest. I know Andrew Luck's probably going to be a guy that's in there, Brandon Whedon. But I don't know if there's one player who maybe means more to his team. I certainly think Robert Griffin means a whole lot more to his team than Andrew Luck does to Stanford and Brandon Whedon does to Oklahoma State. I know that could be up for debate, but we'll talk about that a little bit later on. Let's move forward now. Again, Kansas State with a big, some might call upset, in Austin. They beat Texas for a fourth straight time. 17-13 was the final in this game, and not a whole lot of talking points in this one as far as standout performances. Colin Klein, 26 totes for him, only 4 yards. Chris Harper had a couple of nice catches, including the touchdown that was obviously critical in a game in which Kansas State only managed to manufacture 17 points. The defense, a lot of people are going to say it was a solid performance by the K-State defense, and obviously the D was the catalyst in the victory and the main reason why the Cats were able to get it done. But we'll start off the debate right here. We'll talk about the Cats defense first and foremost. A good performance in terms of the number of yards given up. 310 yards given up is always good regardless of who you're playing. But a little bit of a deflator for me, giving up 191 on the ground to Texas, a team that's extremely banged up at the running back position. I felt the guys were running a little bit slow. I felt Joe Bergeron and Malcolm Brown just a step slower than perhaps they normally would be at full strength. One was suffering from turf toe, the other from a hamstring injury. So obviously they're not at 100%. I think K-State benefited from that greatly. And as far as the passing attack goes for Texas, K-State was put in a very fortunate position to have two young guys leading the charge for the entire game, and particularly towards the end of the game when Texas was forced to go to the air, and a bit of a surprise move in my mind. I would have thought Mack Brown would have maybe tried to stick it out a little bit more with the running game because it was so successful against K-State, but he goes to the air, and I think that was where K-State was able to take advantage because you have a young quarterback in Case McCoy who was panicking, and there's a big-time sense of urgency, and he just wasn't able to perform well and hit guys that were open. That was what I was taking away most from K-State's performance. They didn't negate the passing game from Texas. Texas just didn't take advantage when they had the opportunity to hit open receivers. And I'll start off with that right there. That's my opening statement for this defense. Curtis, what's your take on it? It was a little bit marred in my mind just by the way that Texas was able to run the ball. And as I said, I feel the Cats more so benefited from inexperienced quarterback play than anything else. Would you agree with that statement?
To a point, because I am on the other side of that fence. I thought K-State's defense was pretty good. It didn't put up sick numbers like Texas's defense did, and we can talk about that too. But I thought K-State's defense did exactly what it needed to do, and I thought Bill Snyder said it best after the game when he said, or when he was asked about his defense's performance, and he said, good enough to win. And they were. In that game, when his offense is struggling as bad as it was to hold Texas, freshmen aside, and or freshmen included, excuse me, when you can hold that team to 300, just over 300 yards and hold them to 13 points at home, I think that says that you've done a pretty darn good job. And before Texas made that change to McCoy at quarterback and took Ash out after his second interception, I thought they were bothering McCoy bothering Ash. Excuse me. Yes, part of that was because he was missing throws. Other times, I thought K-State did a good job of generating some pressure along the front four that they had not done recently. Their sack totals had dropped off the map against Oklahoma and Oklahoma State. Two really good offensive lines, but it spoke to how Kansas State just had not been effective or been able to get much done up front, and it was costing them down the field. When quarterbacks like Landry Jones and Brandon Weeden have time to throw, they can kill you. And they didn't give that luxury to David Ash. And I think he probably accentuated that point by not being able to make some throws, especially toward the flat. I was a little bit taken aback, really, at how badly he missed some of those throws that were 8 to 10 yards and toward the sideline. And side story, when I'm sitting in the press box, some of the Texas media, I've obviously seen these guys play all season, and every time Ash would make a throw, they would gasp, and it was more of a sigh, like, oh, man, just because they've seen it a lot. And I didn't realize that it had been that much of an issue for him this season, but he missed some throws. I thought K-State was able to ratchet up the pressure enough to make it uncomfortable on him. And then I thought overall, and I think this is where I was more impressed with K-State, when it became apparent that Texas was going to have to run the ball. They've got some supreme talent in being able to do that. I thought their offensive line was pretty good and opened some holes, but I thought K-State's linebackers, once they were able to key on running backs, finally got back to playing the way that we saw them play early in the year, and that was ball hockey. That was watching a guy make a play or take the ball in the backfield, make a cut, and by the time he hit the hole, there would be somebody there waiting on him. And I thought Trey Walker especially and Arthur Brown, again, like we've seen him do too, I thought those two were really, really good in limiting big runs. And Texas's running backs are young, and they're a freshman, and they didn't play a week and a half ago, but Joe Bergeron and Malcolm Brown both looked pretty darn fast. And I don't know how it looked on television, but in person they were making cuts, and they looked healthy, or at least healthy enough to go. And they broke some bigger runs off, but they weren't ever able to get out into space and really gash K-State's defense. And I think, again, that's important because after it became apparent that Texas wasn't able to throw the ball effectively, K-State was able to key. And then they had to go make plays and make tackles, which had been an issue for the K-State defense in recent weeks. But they shored that up. And, again, like Bill Snyder said, they played just well enough to win. And I felt like that game overall was more indicative of two defenses that knew they were better than the other team's offense and then wielded that to their advantage. And it's been a long time since we've had two defenses that were able to do that in a Big 12 game. But I thought that's how it turned out. And you've got to remember, too, that these are two ranked teams, and they're good. They're good at this point in the season. They're good at what they do. And I thought it was just a good old-fashioned knock them around a little bit, make some hard hits in the running game, and see who can come out on top. And I know it doesn't look good compared to some of the aerial assaults that we're used to. We've gotten used to seeing the last even 5 to 6 or 7 years in this league. But I thought it was a thoroughly entertaining game to watch from a straight football perspective instead of just watching points being put up like a basketball game. I really thought that both teams played hard, and I thought the defenses for both sides were pretty darn good.
Well, before we start breaking down K-State's offensive performance in this football game, I feel like I've got to address something here. You called me out, Mr. Kitchen. You called me out in my recap saying that I'm a little bit too young to remember what good defensive football looks like, and I feel like I've got to defend myself in this situation. I know I'm only 24 years old, but I will say this. I remember watching K-State's dominant defenses of the late 90s. The Cats, in fact, led the Big 12 from 1998 to 2001 in total defense. I remember watching some of the Nebraska blackshirt defenses that were right up there with Kansas State's, and some years they were better, some years they weren't. But even so, Nebraska, a team that was perennially in the top 10 in total defense in the early years of the Big 12, and also throw Oklahoma and Texas up there as well. Once Oklahoma got things going, when Bob Stoops got there, the Sooners always had one of the great defenses in the country. I remember what good defensive football looks like, and I absolutely have a good appreciation for good defensive football. And with that said, I don't think what we saw from Kansas State last week was a dominant defensive performance. I don't even think it was that good of a defensive performance, just because Texas was able to do really whatever they want. There wasn't a whole lot of pressure applied on Case McCoy or David Ash. K-State didn't get a sack until the very late stages of the ball game when a pocket broke down and Case McCoy was forced to eat one. But even so, K-State fails to generate any sort of a pass rush again for really the fourth straight week now. They only make two plays behind the line of scrimmage in this football game. Texas is able to run for almost 200 yards. The passing game, as I've stated, I think K-State didn't do anything. The corners, the secondary players, they didn't do anything to negate what Texas wide receivers could have done. It was just a matter of whether or not David Ash or Case McCoy could get the ball into their hands and let them operate in space. And more often than not, they were misfires by Case McCoy and David Ash. K-State was absolutely the beneficiary of poor quarterback play in this game, and that's why I say it. I don't think it was all that good of a defensive performance from K-State. I can appreciate good defense, as I just said. I just don't think that was what we saw last week, and I'll have to say one more thing about the defense for K-State. It is really, really dipped off here in the past few weeks, and a lot of people aren't calling out Chris Kosh. They aren't calling out any individual players and all this, but you have to acknowledge the fact that it has dipped off tremendously since the beginning of the season. K-State's now fallen all the way down to 73rd in total defense, 77 in scoring defense. Those are not good numbers, and I know a lot of people call me out and they'll say, well, you know, yards don't matter. Well, yeah, they kind of do, because the more yards you give up, even if you keep teams out of the end zone, the more yards you give up, that's more field position you give up. And when you have an offense that's banged up like K-State's, that offense needs good field position. And consequently, you need the defense to stop the other team on their side of the field, not 20 yards into K-State territory. That's not good defensive football. And like I said, I just don't think we saw it last week from Kansas State. I know a lot of people are going to argue with me on that, but it's pretty simple, guys. Yards, more often than not, will eventually translate into points for other teams. And I know K-State has been extremely, extremely fortunate this season to have such a turnover-prone defense, or a defense that's able to force so many turnovers, but that's not going to last forever. And I just don't think you can go into each game banking on 2, 3, 4 turnovers in very critical situations when teams have penetrated deep into K-State territory. That's just not a way to approach defense. I want to see K-State get back to the K-State of old. I want to see aggressive play by the defense. I want to see blitzing. I want to see pressure on the quarterback. I want to see K-State dominate the way they used to do. And I know a lot of people will say you can't do it in today's game of football with so many spread offenses, but you have to look at teams like Texas, teams like Oklahoma. They're able to go out and do it. They are able to make plays behind the line of scrimmage. They're able to do a whole lot of things to disrupt these spread offenses. And I know a lot of it hinges on personnel, but that just says it's still a possibility. You cannot think that you just have to contain spread offenses. There are ways to not only slow them down, but there are ways to make them ineffective. And that's what K-State needs to do going forward. Whether or not it happens, it remains to be seen. I know K-State, it's been a great ride this entire season, and a lot of that has been due to the turnovers that have been forced by the defense. But again, it's something that's not sustainable, I guess is what I'm trying to say. You just cannot rely week in and week out on so many turnovers at critical junctures of the game, because sooner or later you're going to run into a team that's going to take care of the football. And I know it hasn't happened this season, but next season, I'll go on record as saying this right now, K-State will not see the same type of success they've seen this season. They won't see that next season. That's not a knock on K-State. K-State has caught so many teams at the right time this year, and it's been eerie at how fortunate K-State has been and the timing in which they've played teams. It's worked out so well for K-State this season. And again, I don't know if it's sustainable. That's what I'm going to say about the defense. We'll move forward now, transition over to the offensive side of things. You're listening to the Strictly State podcast, available exclusively at kitchenkc.com. Also available on iTunes for download if you want to check it out. Now moving forward now, let's break down K-State's offensive play in this football game. Not a whole lot to write home about for the Wildcats. They average just 2.2 yards per play in this football game, only generate 120 yards of offense. A whole lot of ineptitude on the Kansas State side in this football game. Colin Klein looks to be a little bit banged up, but despite all that, he still carries the ball 26 times, only nets 4 yards against the University of Texas. He does have a fairly nice day throwing the football as far as Colin Klein and just overall how this K-State passing offense has been throughout the season. He does have a fairly nice day throwing the football, goes 9-17, 82 yards, one touchdown, no picks. Probably should have had two touchdowns. I know Chris Harper's probably kicking himself for not catching the second one in the back corner of the end zone, but another story for another day. What's your take on the approach by K-State? And we learned after the game as well that Colin Klein has not been practicing for the last 2 weeks. That's big. To me, that signifies he is hurt in some way, shape, or form. I think that's pretty evident at this point in the season. Would you have liked to see K-State maybe switch up the philosophy on the offensive side of the ball, particularly after that first half in which K-State rushed 19 times for just 2 yards? After Texas completely neutralized K-State's rushing attack, would you like to see K-State maybe go a different direction, try airing it out a little bit more in that second half?
Well, I think so, and I'll say about his rushing total. I mean, that also takes into effect the times that he got hit behind the line of scrimmage and dropped that weren't rushing plays, too. I mean, that goes on his total. So that happened. But, you know, I thought they did try to tailor the plan a little bit and maybe a little bit too much, and it might have even been by Collins' subconscious design, and by that I mean there were times where they would run their zone read and he would give the ball to John Hubert when it wasn't there, and it may have been there more for him to hold on to the ball, take a hit, and try to get forward for 4 or 5 yards, which we've seen him do a lot. You know, that's just that's probably what got him into the position he's in now. But I saw him hand the ball off where it wasn't necessarily the right read. And that happened a lot more earlier in the game, and I think that was more about him saying, I don't need to take a hit here, or I don't want to take a hit here. And I'm giving him benefit of the doubt by saying that I think he read the play, knew that it wasn't there, and just said, we'll just go back and try it again. I do think they did try to change it up later, and especially on the Harper touchdown drive, they did open it up a little bit more. Now, did that have to wait because they were wanting to set Texas up with that? I don't know that for sure. And we don't get to talk to the offensive coaches, so we can't ask them that kind of stuff. But we don't get to talk to any of the coaches for that matter, so we don't get to ask them. But, you know, did they have to run what they were going into the game plan running, or going into that game running overall, in order to try to bring Texas in, bring the safeties up, try to get the corners to press a little bit so then they could, you know, spring the more open plays and see if they could get them? And I thought they did that in the middle of the game. Then Texas, to their credit, made the adjustment, and K-State had to go back to whatever they had left at that point, and obviously it wasn't much. But they did find enough success to score a couple of touchdowns, and I thought really that one drive was the best. And I think you nailed it. They finally did change it up a little bit. But again, I wonder if that was more about in-game design and getting Texas to show its hand a little bit and get comfortable where it was at, and then trying to flip the switch and seeing if they could open it up. And I think, it, you know, obviously it worked. But moving forward about Klein's health, yeah, we've been questioning that for what now, Jeff? Probably 6 weeks, I mean, at least. I mean, it seems like he's been hurt for a long time. Or at least it looked like he was hurt for a long time. The fact that he hasn't practiced for a couple weeks, yeah, I think that automatically seals it, that there was something bigger going on there. You know, I've shared the stories that, you know, he couldn't grip my hand, you know, a month ago, and I'm sure it's been going downhill since. And I don't know, you know, it adds to the legend of Colin Klein, if you will. The kid keeps buckling his helmet up and going out and playing. But this was the first time where I felt like, especially early in that game, that whether he thought about it consciously or not, it looked like that maybe his overall health seemed to dictate his play a little bit when it came to, you know, do I want to take a hit here or do I not? And it seemed like he handed the ball off a couple of times where I don't know that he would have if he was 100% healthy.
Now you look at John Hubert's run totals, and he does get 12 carries, and quite honestly, that's That's a decent number for John Hubert. He hasn't touched the ball all that often. And as far as Colin goes, you certainly cannot question the kid's toughness and his moxie at this point. And he deserves, perhaps more than any other player, he deserves this week off to get himself as healthy as he possibly can going forward. And Colin actually talked about that at Tuesday's press conference, what he's been doing in place of not practicing.
You just play the game mentally, and especially as a quarterback, it's not something that's entirely new just because that's what film study is so valuable with, just because you can never get the amount of physical reps that you need to be able to perform the way you need to be able to perform. So, again, it's just one of those things. It's been a new challenge, something that I haven't had to deal with before, but I'm just trying to do the best I can, and it's been working all right so far.
Colin Klein, certainly a guy who is equipped to handle any sort of mental or physical hardships. He's got a very good head on his shoulders, and he's a very strong-willed individual. I think a lot of people have seen that, obviously, through the course of the season, and he's not the type of guy who's going to come out and admit this, but I think he knows that he is hurting physically, and he needs this off week to get himself rested physically and to get as healthy as he possibly can for this home finale against Iowa State. I don't think anyone would knock him for that. He has taken his fair share of hits through the course of the season, but again, he just finds a way to get it done, and it's been uncanny how the team has not only taken on the persona of Bill Snyder, but the persona of Colin Klein as well. This is something that people don't really have a chance to see on a day-to-day basis, how Colin Klein interacts with the media, but he is a true extension of Bill Snyder. He will rehearse the same exact lines. He will preach getting better every day. He's absolutely a guy that you want running your football team. I don't think there's anybody better that could be quarterbacking the K-State Wildcats at this point. And Colin Klein has led this team now to a 9-2 record following the upset win over the University of Texas. Let's remember, Vegas had the Cats as 9.5-point dogs going into that game. I know quite a few people. I had some friends that went out to Las Vegas over the weekend. I know quite a few people that made a couple of bucks off of that game, and they are very happy that the Wildcats pulled off that upset. Again, K-State, 9.5-point dogs, but they go in and do more than cover the spread. They get the win, 17-13. K-State now has swept all of the Texas schools, and they've even started to print shirts saying Texas State champs on them, and they have the scores against all those Texas schools. I'm not a huge fan of that sort of thing, but this win is meaningful in this sense. Texas has a whole lot of Division I talent that comes out of that state year in and year out. Curtis, what do you think this game means to Kansas State, not only just in getting a huge win in a very hostile environment, but going forward and how this impacts recruiting?
Well, the season by itself is important for recruiting if they take advantage of it. I mean, we've seen K-State waste pretty good years in terms of using that to their recruiting advantage in the past. I really do think that they wasted their Big 12 championship season. I think it's been pretty documented at how some guys on that staff thought that they had arrived, but you know, maybe they didn't have to work quite as hard, and you know, we saw the downturn that program took, you know, pretty much immediately after that. And so you would hope that they learn their lesson. You would hope that they use this whole season and wins like they've had this year. And you're right, against all of the Texas schools, you would hope that they spent more time making sure that they were sending the text messages and talking to the guys that they needed to talk to in Texas who had some sort of interest in playing football at Kansas State, making sure that they pointed that out. And honestly, past that, I'm not much of a T-shirt guy, I admit it, but I know there are people out there who like to have every little bit of piece of history that they can get. This will be one more piece of K-State collateral that they can add to their collection, and that's fun. That's fine. That's fun for them. It's fun that K-State can say that, but I don't know that I need you to go buy me one, if you understand what I'm saying.
Well, no worries there, my friend. I'm saving all the money I make in the lucrative profession of radio, so... Well, obviously that game had huge implications in terms of recruiting going forward for the K-State football program, but it also had huge implications in terms of what's going to happen in the here and now and where the Wildcats are going to end up in the postseason. And we need to talk about this. With so many upsets that happened last week, with Oklahoma State slipping up in Ames, with Baylor picking off Oklahoma, K-State is now in a position to potentially tie for the Big 12 Conference title. And a lot of things still have to fall into place for that to occur, and I'll outline the situation for you. If Oklahoma beats Iowa State this week and then beats Oklahoma State the following week, then Kansas State, Oklahoma, and Oklahoma State would all finish with 7-2 conference records. Oklahoma, by virtue of their two tie-breaking wins over Kansas State and Oklahoma State, would be the Big 12 conference champions. They would get the automatic bid to the Fiesta Bowl. Oklahoma State at 10-2 would probably get the Cotton Bowl in all likelihood. They are still a candidate for an at-large bid, but they in all likelihood will end up in Dallas in the Cotton Bowl. Kansas State, if that occurs, probably going to end up in San Antonio in the Alamo Bowl. But again, still plenty of football left to be played and a myriad of possibilities out there for Kansas State. This team could potentially be an at-large candidate ending up in the Sugar Bowl. They could go to the Alamo Bowl in San Antonio. Still, wherever K-State ends up, obviously it's going to be a great accomplishment for this team to get to 9 wins as they have already, potentially get to 10 with a win over Iowa State. It's been a great ride for Kansas State this season. And Curtis, I want to talk to you now about this. You were on hand in Austin last Saturday. I have to imagine there were quite a few bowl reps on hand, people that were from the Alamo Bowl, people that were from the Cotton Bowl. They were watching this game with very close eyes. What do you think is the most likely scenario that plays out, and where do you think K-State ends up in the postseason?
Well, I my thoughts changed over the weekend, and I'll tell you why here in just a second. But you're right, there's a ton of football to be played still. I mean, if Oklahoma loses to Oklahoma State in a couple of weeks, then I think it becomes a lot clearer picture. If Oklahoma is to beat Oklahoma State, and we end up, and K-State wins, of course, and we have a three-way split Big 12 champion, I think it becomes extremely messy, and I think it becomes extremely important that we remember that bowls are an invite, that bowl committees pick the teams if they have a choice. It's not that they have to, you know, settle on this team or that team. I mean, they bowls get to pick now, and that's important because of what I heard in the press box down in Austin. And granted, take it for what it's worth, it was in Austin, but there were bowl reps there, and the rumor floating around the press box was that Oklahoma and the Fiesta Bowl have been together a lot lately, a lot. And in order to maybe change it up a little bit, re-inject some energy back into that bowl game, maybe it's time to change it up a little bit. The Fiesta Bowl committee, if they have their choice and it comes down to them, if it comes down to a K-State and an Oklahoma, then they may go with K-State because they know that K-State travels well. They know that it would be an exciting finish for that football team and for its fans to an unbelievably unexpected season. And so they're considering it. It's out there. It's not an official report, but it's floating around the Big 12 that if it comes down to bowls getting their choices, especially a high-level bowl like a Fiesta, that they may, not saying they will, I'm saying that they are seriously considering choosing a K-State as opposed to taking Oklahoma again. Looking at it from the flip side, if Oklahoma had not been a part of that bowl as much as it has lately, they probably do pick the Sooners. I mean, the Sooners are a name brand, and not saying K-State's not, but when you compare the two on a national level, I think most people would say Oklahoma's the better-known brand, and rightfully so. That said, if Oklahoma State wins and it ends up that K-State is firmly in between the two schools and not tied with them, then I think you're probably looking at I think the Cotton Bowl wants K-State at this point, especially now that K-State beat Texas. I don't think the Cotton Bowl wants Texas now anymore. Not saying they would turn them down, but if they have their druthers, they would definitely go a different direction. So I would say at least Cotton Bowl, and I can easily see it at a Fiesta Bowl, if it came down to you know, somebody on that committee having to make a choice like I just outlined, I could see K-State easily showing up in Arizona as well.
Well, K-State does have that tradition of being not only one of the best traveling fan bases in the Big 12 Conference, but really one of the best traveling fan bases in the entire country. You know the folks out in Western Kansas. You know the people throughout the state that support this program, the people that come to Bill Snyder Family Stadium week in and week out. You know they've been saving up that money. You know they're looking forward to a big-time bowl destination. They might be rewarded this year as K-State is one of those teams that's in contention for an at-large bid. And I know there's probably quite a few K-State fans out there that aren't all that familiar with the new BCS poll because it's been tweaked quite a bit now since the Wildcats were last relevant in the BCS, which you have to go back again to all the way back to 2003 for the last time that the Wildcats were a fixture in the top 15 in the BCS, and it's changed a little bit since then, but let me lay it out for you, Wildcat Nation. This is what you need to know. To qualify for an at-large bid in the BCS, you have to have at least 9 wins, and you need to be ranked in the top 14 in the BCS standings. K-State's got a check on both counts. The Wildcats are 9-2 on the year. They're currently ranked 11th in the latest BCS poll. They have a chance to move up even higher with a win over Iowa State, obviously. But with all the chaos that's going to unfold, not only this week, but the next week in college football because of all the championship games that are going to be played, all of the big-time football games that are still left to be played, K-State has a very good chance, depending on who wins and who loses, to vault up even higher into the standings to be in the top 10, potentially even in that 9 or 8 range, again, depending on who wins or loses. But still, plenty of great football left to be played. Wildcat Nation, kick your feet up this weekend. Enjoy some of the good football that's going to be on the tube. Enjoy the holidays. With that, we will move into our world-famous pick segment here on the Strictly State Podcast, which, again, is available exclusively at KitchenKC.com. You can also visit iTunes and download it there as well. And, again, make sure to check out the site, KitchenKC.com. Curtis puts out great content week in and week out, day in and day out. If you're looking for the latest information on Kansas State, on the Big 12, any teams in the Kansas City area, check it out, KitchenKC.com. Game one of the world-famous pick segment, what could be potentially the last matchup for the foreseeable future between Texas and Texas A&M. This one's going to go down at Kyle Field on Thanksgiving Day. A huge game in the Lone Star State. There's going to be a lot of venom between these two clubs. There's going to be a lot of energy at Kyle Field, as there always is, but a little added incentive, obviously, as Texas A&M is on its way out to the SEC. We look at the game. From last week, Texas A&M took out a whole lot of aggression on the University of Kansas. They got a big 54-point win over the Hawks. Texas, of course, again, falling at home to Kansas State in a very close game. A lot of interesting storylines in this. Cyrus Gray might not be able to go for Texas A&M. He's really one of the top all-purpose backs in the Big 12's history. Was on the verge of potentially breaking Darren Sproles' record. He's got a separated shoulder, might not be able to make it in this game. You know he's a senior, he's going to do what he can to make it, but I have a hard time believing a guy with a separated shoulder is going to be able to play in this football game for the Aggies. As far as Texas goes, we saw it firsthand last week, a dominant defense does Manny Diaz have in his possession. You know he's going to be dialing up the pressure. It's going to be a lot of Ryan Tannehill for Texas A&M, but even with all that said, you got two freshman quarterbacks for Texas that are going into what's probably going to be the most hostile environment they played in front of all season long. With that said, I just don't like Texas's chances going into Kyle Field and picking up a win.
Yeah, I'll say after watching Texas in person, I think they're a better football team, but where they're better, they're also younger. And I guess in a way it mitigates any real visible improvement, and I think we've seen that this year. They're just sort of there. That said, I'd look out for Texas a year from now and going into next year, and especially 2 years from now. I think they're going to be right back where they need to be, but they're not there yet. They're still learning, like you said. They're learning how to deal with tough losses like they just had at home. The seniors on that football team, I mean, you've got to remember things like the seniors on that team just have been dealing this week, walking around campus and walking into practice every day knowing that they lost their last home game on senior day. I mean, that kind of stuff sticks with you. And you can go with it two ways. If you're good enough, you can take that and use it as motivation, go out and find yourself a win against that Texas A&M. Or if you're not good enough, then it doesn't help you to think about it because you've got to be fully prepared to take on a sneaky Texas A&M team. And we've seen them. They're able to move the ball. Their offense is good enough. It's just sometimes they lose their focus at times. And I think if Texas gets back to what it does well, and I think that's obviously run the ball first and then just ask your quarterbacks to make some reasonable throws and not ask them to go win a game like they had to try to do at the end against K-State and couldn't do it, as we saw, then I think Texas has a better shot. That said, you know, I don't know. You know, is A&M just you keep looking for patterns with A&M, and I don't think you can find any. One week they seem to be rolling, another week they seem to be focused, and then a week later they seem to lose all of it. And then they might go through a two-game swoon where they're just not quite there, and they're missing things. So, boy, I like Texas's defense a lot. I'm not saying K-State's offense is all, you know, it's not, you know, going to win any awards, obviously. It's not going to win you a beauty pageant, but they're better than what they had happen on Saturday. And I think a lot of that went with Tech because of Texas's scheme and the athletes they put on that side of the ball. So if Texas is able to wreak some havoc against A&M's offense and then get some plays, just get themselves a little bit right after things didn't go well, like you pointed out, against K-State. I don't think it's going to be a blowout by any means. I think it's going to be a big game, and I think Texas wants to right itself. You know, even if it's on the road, I'll take Texas in that game.
I could definitely see Texas pulling off what might be considered a minor upset in this game. I mean, obviously Texas and A&M, 6-4 and a 6-5 football team going at it in College Station this weekend. There's a whole lot of playmakers on this defense, and you talked about the youth. I think this offense in a few years, once it gets things righted, they're going to be very tough to handle. The defense going to have to go through a bit of a rebuilding process next year. They'll be losing guys like Keaston Randall, Keenan Robinson, Emmanuel Acho. Let's not forget about Blake Gideon. And a whole lot of playmakers on the defensive side of the ball. I do like A&M. I like the home field for them this weekend, but it's going to be a very tightly contested football game. No doubt in my mind this one's going to go down to the wire at College Station. A&M's defense isn't all what it's cracked up to be. It's very similar statistically to K-State's. A few more playmakers perhaps than the Wildcats do have, but I like Texas's chance to move the ball a little bit. Obviously, Bergeron and Brown going to be a little bit healthier this week. I think it's going to be a game that goes right down to the wire, but again, I'm going to defer to the home team and take A&M in a very close one-possession win. And going forward now, another team from the old Southwest, they are now in the SEC, Arkansas. They are playing LSU in the Bayou, a massive game, as we all know now. The top three teams in the BCS poll go LSU 1, Bama 2, Arkansas 3. Arkansas wins. They are in the SEC championship game. They would, in all likelihood, leapfrog Alabama in the standings. A huge game, monumental implications as far as who's going to play in the national title game. A lot of things on the line in this one, but it's at Death Valley. Who do you like?
Now, I've seen LSU rise to this occasion multiple times. I don't think it can be underestimated or talked about enough that I think the best part of LSU's defense is in its secondary, from what I've seen so far this year, and that's going to match up pretty well against what Arkansas wants to do offensively. And I just across the board don't know that one that Arkansas's defense it's not going to shut LSU down like Alabama did. It's going to give up its share of points, and I think LSU's defense is going to limit or make some plays that's going to limit Arkansas more than they're used to. So all of that said, it would be a great story just to see the whole thing get flipped up on its head if Arkansas won. I still say that LSU is going to win that game.
It's so hard for me to pick Arkansas in this situation, and particularly if you look at there's really one game that I look to when you compare these two squads. Both teams played at Alabama this year. Arkansas lost 38-7. LSU won 9-6. That's one of the games that I look at. LSU's defense, as we all know, it's lights out. Arkansas's offense, a very explosive bunch. Obviously, something's going to have to give this weekend. I'm going to go out on a limb. I've seen this game a few times, and I've seen LSU stumble at home to Arkansas. I remember when Darren McFadden went off for a huge day back in 2007 when they ended up knocking off LSU that year. I think that Arkansas is going to pull off what's going to be a huge upset, and I think that win, if Arkansas does in fact pull this off, that is going to truly unleash the chaos. If we thought last week was chaotic as far as the BCS goes, then everything goes out the window if LSU loses, because then the only undefeated team that's going to be left in college football will be Houston. There's going to be a myriad of one-loss teams that are vying for that 1-2 spot. So I'm rooting for chaos this week. I say call on the Hogs. I'm taking on. I'm going to pick Arkansas in an upset at LSU. We'll move forward now. Games coming up. Again, a lot of great football on tap for this week. And, of course, Thanksgiving weekend, you got a whole lot of rivalry games. And not the one we've been accustomed to seeing, but a new one. The Corn Bowl. Iowa and Nebraska. This one being played in Lincoln, an 11 a.m. kick on ABC. And it has been determined the winner will get the Corn Bowl trophy. And this was voted on by the students. A very innovative name right there. But, who's your pick to win this one? It's tough for me. Nebraska looked just terrible against Michigan last week. Iowa, not the Iowa they've been in years past. Who do you like in Lincoln?
Right, and I'll stick with that. Iowa is just not the Iowa that we all thought we used to know. And they're just not quite as hard-nosed. They're not quite as lights out on defense, and they don't have that bruising running game that they used to have. And all of that said, you know, I know, like you said, Nebraska struggled. I'm not sure. I didn't actually get to see the game, but that score surprised me, especially when it got out of hand, because that was a reasonable game in the third quarter, if I remember right. But every time after that, it just seemed like Michigan piled it on. I think Nebraska comes back. I don't think the Corn Huskers are going to allow the inaugural Corn Bowl trophy or whatever the heck that thing is, a golden corn cob or whatever the thing is going to look like. I don't think they're going to let that thing go across a state line, so I'll take Nebraska.
Yeah, I'm going with the Big Red as well. They've struggled against dual-threat quarterbacks, and obviously Denard Robinson is one of the best in the country. And you look at their losses, Russell Wilson in Wisconsin, Russell Wilson's a dual-threat. Kane Coulter, the young man from Northwestern, who's Northwestern's second-leading rusher, he gave Nebraska a whole lot of problems when he came in. We saw Nebraska losing that one, and most recently, as I just stated, against Michigan. Not the case. Iowa does not have a dual-threat quarterback in Vanderberg. I like the Big Red's chances to get win number 9 on the season. I think they take the inaugural Corn Bowl trophy. Another game featuring a team from Iowa, and this one has taken on a whole lot more intrigue, particularly following last week's upset. Iowa State now 6-4 on the year. Bowl eligible again are the Cyclones. They will get to face an Oklahoma team that's dropped down to number 9 in the BCS poll now. This one being played in Norman, but you gotta like Paul Rhodes' squad, and I don't know necessarily for an upset in this one, but you gotta like the way that they're coming into this game, pulling off the huge upset. Oklahoma's coming in a little bit down. And the way they refocused themselves after the loss to Tech is one thing, but they've endured so many injuries since then, and now all of a sudden the talk of a Big 12 title could go out the window this week. Does OU rise to the occasion, or do we see Iowa State pull off another shocker?
No, I think it could be a good game, no doubt, but I think Oklahoma gets it done at home. Injuries aside, I think they will find a way to rally around the point that they've got to win their last two, and if they do, that they get to call themselves a co-champion of the Big 12. I know a lot of people, that seems to be, the side story seems to be, people are torn on, who gets to call themselves, champion if all three are still up top. But for my money, they all played each other. They all lost to different teams, granted, but they all finished with the same record. So, yeah, heck yeah, all three should call themselves co and then figure it out past that. That said, I think that gives Oklahoma something to play for. They get to play, try to redeem themselves and then get themselves right. They can look at this game as a one game tune-up for Oklahoma State, and obviously the styles are different, the level of talent is different, and on and on and on. But I say all of that even though Iowa State just beat Oklahoma State, but I think Bob Stoops he'll use this as a measuring stick, or not even a measuring stick, a point of emphasis this week to get themselves right. They've got a chance to win their last three, if you count two games and then a bowl game, and they'll pick up some hardware along the way if they do. So all of that on the table. I think the Sooners go ahead and rebound, just because on the other side, I don't know that Iowa State can really just bring the same level of excitement that they did the week before, and the excitement of knocking off Oklahoma State. I don't know how you're able to get back up to that same level in a short time frame. I don't see it this week for Iowa State, so I'll take Oklahoma.
I'm with you. I don't think lightning strikes twice for Iowa State in this game. I think it'll be a lot more competitive than what people are thinking right now, and a lot of people are probably going to look back to the way that Oklahoma rebounded against K-State after they lost to Texas Tech. I think we'll see a little bit more lethargic team, maybe a team that's not completely in tune to start things off for Oklahoma, but I think they will find a way to win. There's quite a few more athletes, obviously, on Oklahoma's side of the ball than Iowa State's, and like I said, I just can't see Iowa State pulling off a second monumental upset in as many weeks. I love Paul Rhodes, and his guys would run through a brick wall for him, but I just don't see it from Iowa State in back-to-back weeks. We'll wrap things up with the final, at least for the foreseeable future, the final border war, Kansas and Missouri and Arrowhead this Saturday. This one's going to kind of bring a little bit of a tear to my eye, truth be told. I've been to this game a number of times. A lot of my family, they are big Missouri Tiger fans. Missouri's actually never lost. They are 5-0 when I go to this game. So obviously my family's looking forward to seeing me in the stands with them this Saturday. I know we talked about all the external distraction with Pinkel and the DUI, but Missouri was able to overcome it last week. Pinkel's back this week. It's the really what could be for the next few years, or for quite a while, the last border war. Who do you like in this one? I know Turner Gill, he might be able to buy himself some time with a win, but I'll just ask you, who do you like?
Well, it's very simple for me. It's one reason and one reason only. One of these teams looks at this as a rivalry and has been quoted in the paper this week as saying that they hate the other team and they don't ever want to see the other team win a game ever again. And that if they went 0-12 every year, it wouldn't hurt their feelings. And the other side says, we're not going to really, talk up the rivalry. We're just going to try to find ways to make our team better. I'll let you try to figure out those two teams, but I'll take the team that is angry, and it doesn't matter what the other team's record is. They want to go out and smoke the other team, and when they've got more talent on top of it, I will take the Missouri Tigers.
It's really hard to pick. It's really hard to pick the Hawks with the way that they played, and so many people. It really did look like for a short period of time there that Turner Gill had gotten KU not to turn a corner, obviously, but had gotten the kids to play a little bit better, had proven that they were willing to listen and demonstrate what Turner Gill is trying to coach. They had two great efforts against Iowa State and Baylor, albeit in losing efforts, but they played very well in those football games, and they did everything they could to win, and they end up losing by a field goal in one and then on a missed two-point conversion in the other. I know KU's shown a little bit of life, but that all really went out the window with the way that they played at Kyle Field this last Saturday. I know they're going to try their hardest to regroup and to refocus and really channel whatever they have left into this game against Missouri on Saturday. But even with all that said, the Tigers, they're going to want to go out with a win in this series. They've got more talent. They're going to be excited. I'd have to believe they're going to be excited and enthusiastic to play with Coach Pinkel again, to have him out of the fold the past week. Had to have been maybe awkward would be the best way to put it. Not have your coach, obviously, is something you're not accustomed to on a week-to-week basis. So I think they're going to be excited to go out there with Pinkel and finish this rivalry off for at least the foreseeable future with a win over the Kansas Jayhawks. I'm taking the Missouri Tigers to not pull off an upset, but to rather beat the Jayhawks handily in the final Border War showdown. And with that, we'll close up shop here on another edition of the Strictly State Podcast. Thanks again for listening. Remember, it's available exclusively at kitchenkc.com. Also available on iTunes for download. Thanks again for listening to this episode of the Strictly State Podcast. We'll check in with you guys next week. Until then, enjoy the holidays and happy Thanksgiving.
You have been listening to the Strictly State Podcast with Curtis Kitchen and Jeff Burkhart. Visit KitchenKC.com each week for the latest installment of the show, as well as in-depth feature stories on K-State and other area sports teams.